Hello, fellow humans. Welcome to Uncharted Living. We are your hosts, Christine, Rebecca, and Ty. We are business owners, corporate leaders, and life coaches. Join us each week for authentic, thought-provoking, and entertaining conversations. We'll discuss a variety of topics, from personal wellness and professional growth to creativity and spirituality, all designed to help you create your own map for your life. We are excited to partner with you on your uncharted journey. Uncharted living, it's just the beginning. Don't be afraid to get life started. Jump off the map and live uncharted. Hi, everyone. Today we're sharing the ways we live uncharted. Each of us is going to pick one area of our lives to share, to answer the question, how do you live an uncharted life? My answer of how I live uncharted is through my parenting. I have two kids. They are 13 and 15 years old, so that's fun. My parenting has been a journey as my kids have gotten older. So the journey started when they were born, and I was in a heteronormative marriage. The whole idea of what I was sold to want by society, pretty stable, living in my hometown. And I parented that way, that matched my surroundings. And then as I changed surroundings, divorcing my husband and marrying my wife, my parenting evolved with me. So my parenting has taken the uncharted route because my life has, and I couldn't be happier about my life taking that turn and my parenting following.
You're talking about the shift in parenting. Can you walk us back to that point where the shift was happening, of like what was going on in your mind at that point of like realizing that you were heading into uncharted territory with your kids?
The kids were, well, my daughter, who was born first, you know, is the one who makes you a parent. You think you're doing okay until your kid does something that reveals all the cracks that were already there, that you were just kind of like, you had this glue, but that glue was just kind of like a clear nail polish. So one little like crack is like, psh, the whole thing falls apart. And so to answer your question, my daughter was and is a very careful, thoughtful, wary person, just by her nature. That is her essential self. And she used to be very uncomfortable in loud social situations. And one time I was in this like toddler mommy and me type class, and we had gone maybe, I don't know, 10 times to the same place with the same people and then the same thing. She was about a year and a half. Everything was great. We walked in. She walked in, looked around, and she put her entire little body in a cubby, like in one of the cubbies that you put your, you know, your stuff, your lunch and stuff in. I was like, okay, that's new. Never seen that move before. But she couldn't handle the stimulation of the room, and she fixed it for herself. She wasn't crying. She wasn't like, I need you to fix something for me. She stuck herself in the cubby. And here I am as a well-socialized woman who was taught to hug your relatives and smile and be nice. And there's my kid in a cubby. And at that point, I had already dealt with this enough to be like, well, she's in a cubby. I didn't make excuses, and I didn't pull her out. And even though I was pretty well versed in that language at that time, I'd had that kid, that very highly sensitive kid, and was practiced in honoring that. It was so hard for me to just not try to fix her and not try to fix everybody else. Everybody was like, is everything okay? What's going on? And I'm like, she feels like
judgments.
She needs,
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's,
although I think there's people would behave better if they got to go in their own cubby every day.
I was going
to
say, can we have cubbies for parties?
Yeah.
Or, you know, can we just, I would just really love some cubbies everywhere we go. Well, this is amazing. Took care of herself.
It's nice to be really small to fit in a cubby. And that was a moment, you know, as a parent, you really have to sit with an uncomfortable feeling, honoring your child, honoring yourself, and then having to negotiate the people that are there with you. It's tough, and it never ends. And I think parenting kind of sucks because it doesn't ever end. You still have this kid no matter where you are, and you never know how well you're doing. But I think things like that moment, I can say, I stayed with me. I stayed with my kid, and that's the best I can do. I wasn't pushed into bringing her out. Trust is the main thing that I use as my parenting compass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I trust my kid because I have no reason not to, and that started really, really early for me. So mm-hmm. I was the one who was letting my kid make scrambled eggs at 2 years old on a stool on a real flame. I was the one who had my kids never had, you know, fake. They had these scissors. I mean, they at 1 year old, they were using scissors because I was like, those other scissors don't fucking cut. You know, what the fuck is that? Just give them like, you know, like if you give them a tool that works, then they learn to use the tool.
Right.
So it was like the unchartedness of this whole thing. Is it, how did you get to that point where you were like, mm-hmm. this is what we're doing? We're doing it this way. Were you raised like that?
I was raised like that. I was raised in a certain way that just by the definition of who we were in greater like society of suburban America, we didn't really fit in. I had divorced parents. I had a hyphenated last name. I'm half Japanese American and half white. Like there were so many different things that my parents kind of didn't embody of the norm. And I think that's what we mean when we're saying uncharted. It's like off that, you know, white picket fence thing. There was like, it was too late. I mean, you don't go around town with your last name, Ishizuka Cab, and, you know, think that things are going to be just like, this is the 80s, people. Like, you know, it was real weird. You know, there's only so much Esprit and Benetton you can wear to make, you know, you try to like fit in with the rest. So,
oh my God.
I think that to your point, Becca, it was easier for me to raise my kids that way because in some way I was raised. Also, we were Buddhist. We have no commonality with God. As the daughter of filmmakers and photographers, we were really into photos. And again, in the 80s, guess what? We didn't have iPhones. We had cameras with film that you had to load and had limitations on the medium and had to light correctly. And who likes everything lit correctly? Your photographer parents. And so every Christmas morning, my brother and I would run into my parents' room and say, "It's Christmas, it's Christmas." This is a Buddhist Christmas. I mean, well, this is another podcast. But it's like, "It's Christmas, it's Christmas, it's Christmas. Come on. Like, let's go, let's go, let's go." Because we knew all these presents were, you know, from Santa that we were about to open. And my parents were like, "Okay, we'll get dressed." And then they slowly got dressed. And then my mom slowly put makeup on. And my dad slowly got the camera ready. So mom was trying to look good for the camera. My dad was trying to get everything right for the photo. And my brother and I, in real time, you know, the impatience was going up and the joy was going down. And so by the time we went to see the Christmas presents, it was like, oh, fucking finally. And then they were like, don't you guys like it? Okay, smile. Okay, pose. Okay, hold this up. That's too high. Okay, a little bit to the left. And there was so much direction in the photos that it was like, this is all performative. I both love the fact that we don't have to have cameras that way anymore. I can bust out my camera, but I mean, my phone when I want to, but I hardly take pictures on Christmas morning, and I purposefully never take photos when my kids come out and see their presents, because I want them, me, to be there with them in the moment. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just, now we've gone full circle. So instead of getting the fucking camera ready, people are getting their, you know, Insta-reel ready or whatever fucking social media ready, that I, all, you know, that's a whole nother podcast. So it's something that you have to do on purpose, I guess. The uncharted parenting is, you have to do that on purpose. And that's one of the things I do on purpose, is I don't do a lot of direction of the people with the presence or any other day of the year, really.
Let life happen.
Yeah, that's a good mm-hmm. one. I let life happen. I try to. Two stories I have in my back pocket for when I feel like a terrible parent. When my son was about 7, we were shopping in a grocery store, and I'm in with the cart, and he's way back in the aisle. And I'm like, bro, what are you doing? He's just standing in the aisle, staring at the aisle, looking up at something. And I walk back and, you know, I'm just like, let's get going. What's going on? What do you need? And he is murmuring to himself, it's real. It's real. And I'm like, okay, he's tripping. He's like, what's going on? Do we have to call the doctor? Like, what the fuck? And I look, you know, you look at where he's standing to like where he's looking, and I look, and he's looking at Campbell's soup can.
Oh.
And he said, it's real. And I said, what's real? He said, the soup is real. And I was just like, I win, because he had only ever seen Campbell's soup in Andy Warhol paintings. His only reference. That's
very sophisticated, for yeah. sure.
Yeah. And you don't know that when you're doing the thing. You're not being like, yeah. you know, with the flashcards yeah. and baby Einstein bullshit, you know, like, this is Andy Warhol. You're just doing your life. But I was like, check. And I have awesome. Put that in my pocket forever. Mm-hmm. And then my other, with my daughter, who's now 15, when she was 13, she comes to me and says, Mom, do you have, you know, one of those flexible measuring tapes? And I'm thinking, uh-huh. And she's like, can I borrow it? I need to measure myself. And I'm like, holy oh. fuck. Uh-oh. Oh, here it starts. 13-year-old, like, measure? Again, I'm like, mm-hmm. So I just bit my tongue again. I hand her the measuring tape, and she proceeds to measure her fucking bicep. And she's like, it's almost 11 inches, Mom. I think it's growing. I think I'm getting stronger. Awesome. My goal is 12 inches. And I was like, oh my God. There's a feeling of like insane relief compared, you know, with like insane joy. And I was like, fucking yes, win. So those yeah. are my two okay. wins for
all over my body on that one.
I know.
Those she are my to those add are my ones, you guys.
Instead of subtract, which is yes. what women are supposed to be obsessed with. It's less. You mentioned something at the beginning of your story that I'm still thinking about. You said, and it could be we might need a whole new conversation for this, but you said, my parenting has been evolving as I have evolved. Right. Wow.
We're not the same people. Mean? Where it means I'm embracing the idea that I can change, that mm-hmm. nothing is the same. Why should I expect my kid to be like me or fulfill any of my dreams for them because they're their own person. Also working with kids, you really understand the idea that you're never the same person from day to day, month to month, year to year. And so to have that insight from a professional level as an academic coach, I have the privilege of working with kids at different points when they need me. So they might have needed me in fifth grade and now they need me in 10th grade. And I get to re-know this person who I already knew, but they're a whole different person. They look, I mean, and when they're that young, obviously they look different, they sound different, they act different. And I'm really trying to get on that idea, I'm not doing it perfectly, of course, that as adults, we also are changing. Why should we be static when we're so dynamically changing until the age of what, 25, 30? And then people start to be very complacent. Oh, well, now I've done my, I have my job, I have my family, whatever. But I'm trying always to embrace the idea that I can change. And so the way I eat can change, the way I drive can change, the way I parent can change. And I mean, hopefully towards a better place, everything will eventually decline because that's the circle of life. But right now at the age of 48, I am still trying to be better than I was last year. I don't know if I am, but, that's my goal. And that's my parenting goal is to do that.
Yeah. It sounds like you're committed and it's just really good inspiration to being the parent that your kids need you to be at whatever age. Mm. So at one, they need you in a different way. At five, they need you in a different way. At 15, they need you in a much different way. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it can be really disorienting, but if you kind of match your parenting to how they need you and you keep, but the one constant is just keep showing up. But I think being willing to adjust to how they need you and being willing to adjust your parenting to accept that. I mean, case in point, right? I'm not going to micromanage your grades. Like now I'm going to trust you, but I'm here so that you can talk to me about other things that you need. And so that's really good. And I think a lot of people are still stuck in the same, like, well, even though you're 15, I'm still going to make all your snacks and I'm still going to tell you what to eat. And I'm still going to, you know, make sure you check in every 4 minutes and I'm going to cut your grapes for you, you know, even though you're 15. And that just doesn't work.
The idea that moms and dads and everybody continues to evolve, right? It's just so, I don't know, so good.
We try. Everybody does what you can on your own time.
Yeah.
We're trying. So Becca, you can't copy me because I know you don't have any kids. So I'm really curious how you're living in an uncharted way.
Sort of ironically, my story that I prepared to share with all of you starts when I was a child. So going back to the those years, I grew up in a very pretty typical Midwest small town. Is linked in the Bible Belt, right? So there's a lot of like cultural things that go with that. There's a lot of religion that goes with that as well. So I'm no exception there. I grew up in a family that is fundamentalist Baptist, and they still are. So what that means for this conversation, I think it means a lot of things, but for this conversation, what that really looked like was a lot of chartedness, a lot of looking outside of yourself to get information from the culture around you. Essentially also including, you know, a heavy dose of patriarchy in that, you know, you're the men are the head of the households. And then on top of that, there's, you know, And this is where, you know, some will differ. The community I grew up in also would have said in terms of their doctrine that, you know, women are meant to just be helpers, helpers in the home, helpers in community. So women are not allowed to have positions of leadership. And so there's a lot of, like, from the beginning, and this, there's a story I remember, and I was very little, I was probably 8 or something. My mom had gone somewhere for the weekend to visit family or something. And so my dad had had some, like, friends over, some buddies of his over. And I was like 8. And I knew that it was my job at that age to get them food. Like, I was like, what do we have in the kitchen? And brought them chips or pretzels or something, like something very, like, simple and easy. But I, like, put it on the table, and one of them said to me, like, oh, wow, you're going to make a really great wife one day.
I was raised Baptist. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you were.
I will say this, and now we non-denominational. So I'm getting my master's in theology and women. And just for our listeners and for you, Becca, the word for helper that has been translated in the Bible as, like, oh, you know, God makes Adam and then he needs a, quote, helper. That word is actually only ever used in the rest of the Bible to talk about God as our helper. And the word actually means, so, like, in formation for soldiers, right? They would actually walk in a formation and hold, like, kind of almost in, like, a triangle type shape, right? And the very tip soldier was the helper. It's actually the most important part of that formation. So if anyone tells you helper means serving freaking pretzels, that's not what it means. It means actually, like, basically helper in the same way that God helps us. It's not pejorative. It's not submissive. And it has been misconstrued. And that's why I'm finally, I'm still a practicing Christian. I love Jesus, but I could not handle what's going on patriarchy wise and how everything has been translated. And I'm going back to school so that I can argue for it myself and be like, this is all wrong. This has all been a giant misinterpretation that just continues to perpetuate power. So I'm just, you know, for anyone who's in the Midwest or in the South or anywhere, that is not what helper means. It does not mean going to get pretzels. It actually means having help in the same way that the same power that God does.
So I think that's really beautiful.
That was good.
Yeah.
Need to teach us more, Christine. Oh,
there's a, through events that followed, like, okay, the experience I had sitting in that church in that moment was like, there was something in me that knew that you were right. Like, there was a lightning bolt moment where I just was overwhelmed with this sense as a 13-year-old sitting there of, like, my life is not meant to look like any of this that I see around me. Mm. It's not meant to look like this. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that would look like. I didn't know any other example or way of being other than what was right in front of me, right? And that's just why it's one of the reasons why representation is so important. Yeah. I really, like, hook, line, and sinker bought into the entirety of some of those trainings and beliefs. So I ended up going to Bible college immediately from, you know, graduating my little Christian school that was attached to the church. Went to a Bible college because universities would have been, you know, whatever.
That was what was expected of you.
It was what is expected of me. Yes, exactly. Right.
And you probably learned about the patriarchal Bible, not, like, right. I mean, did it perpetuate the same?
Oh, yeah. It was very
interpretation.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it was specifically chosen because it was within the same sort of, like, doctrine and ideas that I had grown up with. So the idea and the undercurrent arriving on campus, and this is, like, let me paint you the picture of, like, being in this school is in downtown Chicago. There's no secret. I went to Moody Bible Institute, downtown Chicago. It takes up an entire city block in downtown, and it's like the walls of the school, of the college. Like, you can't really like see into like what's happening. It's like people walk by, like normal people walk by, and they're just like, what the fuck is that? Like, who, what are they doing in there? Like, what's
going on? That's how I feel when I used to live near the Scientology Center.
Like, you're like, what the hell?
It's quite not. I want to
get too close.
Yeah.
It's like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. No one ever goes in. No one ever comes out.
Like, oh. You never come out.
Were there Oompa Loompas inside?
Yeah. There really were. I mean, you know, like having come from like a purity culture of like, I had a few boyfriends in high school, but really like nothing that serious and nothing anyway. So I get to college at this Bible college and I'm studying psychology. I'm studying family counseling with an early childhood development. And my real vision was to like open a counseling program with like within a church somewhere. That was like my idea. I had always been in leadership. So I was like an RA on campus. I led mission trips. I like was really involved. There was this underlying current that you graduate with a life partner, right? That like you're really there to like find a husband because yeah, you might have some impact on your own, like you might have some things to do, but like really,
I think to be they call impactful, it. You're gonna I think they call it. Yeah, you come back and you get your MRS, right?
You get your MRS degree.
Yeah, not yeah. your MA. That's, your MRS.
That's right.
What's MRS?
What is that? What? Translation, yeah, please.
Mrs.
Oh,
like you get married. Of
course. It's a terrible joke.
Yeah, it's a joke.
I was like, oh my God, what does that mean?
I didn't know.
Am I supposed to know that? Because I don't.
Is that a secret? I told you, I don't know any, I didn't even know about God. So I definitely don't know about that. Oh, Jesus Christ.
So you were supposed to find a husband. That was a chart. That was a map. Okay. I'm dying to know. So how did you get out of that?
So I'm in the Willy Wonka chocolate factory of the Bible college in the inner workings. And I was dating this man who at the time, like wonderful guy. It was like my 13-year-old self, like fat, like there was like a direct line linking me. And all of a sudden one day I realized like, oh my God, if I move forward and marry this guy, cause like it was kind of heading down that road. I mean, it was heading down the road of like, if we're going to move forward, we need to start talking about this getting married situation. It like hit me like a ton of bricks again in this moment of like, if I marry this guy, I know exactly what my life will be. I will be living in small town Ohio. I will be a youth pastor's wife. I'll have like 4 to 5 children. My entire life will be inside of a small church and my life will not be my own. I will wake up at 40 and want to bolt the fuck out of there. Like, I will not be able to do this for the rest of my life. And I couldn't really explain that to him very well. Like, I didn't know how to communicate that at the time. So I basically just told him, like, I can't do this anymore. Sorry, bye. And he was like, what? Like, this is a little whiplashy. What's going on? And I was like, yeah, I don't even know. I can't even tell you. Bye. Like, can't do it. Like, we're done, you know? I didn't know what that meant. And there's a piece of this that I think is important is, like, I didn't grow up, like I didn't have, like there was like a not even a room in my brain or a space in my brain that had unlocked or opened the notion or the idea that I was gay, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I had this dueling within myself at that time to like break free of that. It happened for me very organically and very slowly and like very sweetly in a way that I, you know, one of my friends from this college, I graduated. They were a little bit younger than me. So they were still there on campus and still full-time student. And they'd come to see me up at my apartment and, you know, hang out, all these things. And one thing just led to another. And we developed an intimate relationship. And it was my first girlfriend my first sexual relationship, my first everything, right? Completely rocked my world. And I will say, like, they go by they, them pronouns now, so I'll refer to them in that way, but I feel like it's important for the story and for the context to know that, like, at the time, it was my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So it was very clearly there was this piece within myself, and I'm maybe fast-forwarding a little too quickly here, but I, you know, there's many details I could share. Really, the gist of it is there was like, that was the first time where I really was like, oh, my essential self and my social self are not the same thing. Like I had felt it before in these bolts of clarity where like I could feel myself coming through and I could feel connection to a higher spirit, but it wasn't the God I knew. And so I almost had to throw out the baby with the bathwater for some time. Like it was hard for me to, once I really let myself go down that path, I couldn't entertain. I had to really separate myself from it because so much of my socialization and my community had been embedded in that. I needed to find that self, that place within myself, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm.
Had you even known a gay person?
No.
Or at least someone who had openly talked about being gay before that time?
You know, there were a couple of people sprinkled throughout my life that were like, oh, I think so-and-so's sister is gay, you know? But it was always like, whoa, like they're over there. They don't
sin struggle over there is
yes. Yeah. Like don't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Just like we don't touch sex before marriage with a 10-foot pole. And just like we don't touch, you know, any of these other things. It was just sort of like lumped as like an us them. Like we have the answers, we know, they don't. And they just really, what they really need is Jesus in their life, you know? And I don't say that in a way, because I want to be sensitive to the fact that like, and Christine, I appreciate you bringing these things up in a way that is like so thoughtful and so intentional, because there's so much healing in that for people who have had more traumatic experiences with religion in general, the negative sides of like that power dynamic. My partner at the time, there was this year-long dating relationship that was secret. We did not tell a single person because we were like we would, you know, we would like go on a weekend trip and we would have this amazing time. And then like Monday would roll around and I'd be like, I can't do this anymore. You know, I'd have this like come to Jesus moment where I'd be like, this isn't who I am. Like, cause I was so at war with my social self and my
literal
self,
right? Like, come to Jesus moment.
Literal.
Be in the moment. Yeah. When I let myself be in the moment, I was like, this is like, I finally feel like myself here. I feel like I can be totally honest with this person. I've never, you know, and then I would have all these like flooding of things like the guilt, the, all the things. And, you know, I had to sort through all of that. So there were periods of time within that year where like we would break up and we would get back together. One time in particular, we had broken up and my partner at the time had gone back to campus because that's where they lived, and was crying in a stairwell and really wrestling with like, how do we move forward? And I was probably crying on my bed at my apartment. Like it was just a very like tumultuous time. And we really only had each other to confide in because there was no one that we trusted to share the information with. Mm-hmm. So no one knew. In this moment, there they are crying in the stairwell. And someone, I think it was their RA, came in and, you know, I was like, what's going on? Why are you crying? Can I do anything for you? And through some coercion, the whole thing comes spilling out, and it needed to, right? Like it was to the point where like the truth really needed to be said in some way, shape, or form. The fallout of that was, you know, okay, well, you know, sit tight. Like everything's gonna be okay. Da-da. Ended that conversation. The very next morning, my partner was called into the dean's office at the school.
And this was at the Bible college?
Yeah.
So both of you were at the Bible college.
I had graduated because I was a few years older. I was living in an apartment off campus, but they were still there. Yeah, they were still in the dorms on campus. So they were pulled into the dean's office and told, you know, you have to go to, like, A, first of all, like, we heard that you're in a relationship with a woman. And the funny thing was, like, I had been an RA on campus, like a resident assistant on campus. Like, I knew the leadership team. Nobody ever reached out to me from the school. Like, no one ever checked in. And I don't necessarily, I don't know that at the time I even would have wanted them to, but this is just how it all unfolded, right? So they are told, first of all, like, you can't ever see Becca again. Like, that you need to, like, have no contact with her. Like, oh, don't, there's zero.
And who's going to monitor that? Aren't you both adults?
Well, the second piece of that was, the second piece of that was reparative therapy. So,
oh my God.
Conversion.
Oh my God.
Like, mandatory. Like, and your first appointment was like today at 2. So, show up there kind of thing. And then there was like a monitoring process that involved, I don't even know who, at the, like, I, don't even know who on the leadership team there. So there was like a process that they had for dealing with these kinds of things. And financially speaking, like we were both sort of just like, you know, unsure of how to handle this. We felt we were up against a larger system because we were. And so we just kind of, unfortunately, they went to reparative therapy for the rest of the semester. And we just, I would like park around the corner or like pull up around the corner and like pick them up to like take them back up to the apartment. We would spend as much time as we could together, but we had to be really careful about like who saw us and like where we went out in the city. Cause I mean, Chicago is like a big city, but it's also neighborhoods. Like there are, you run into people anyway. So I say all that to say like shit hit the fan in a way at that point where I really had to like dig in. And that was the first time where like Uncharted made sense to me. I was like, oh, my entire foundation is gone. I wasn't talking to my family when I came out to them at the time. There wasn't like all of my friends didn't really understand because they hadn't been a part of the process. I hadn't included them in any of the process. So for them, this was a little bit of whiplash. Fortunately, like they were able to get through that semester and then they did not go back afterwards, like went a different route and are happily partnered and we're still in touch and they're amazing, wonderful soul that I feel so grateful for. But that was really a time where it was like, okay, like this is a moment of like, I could go this route. I know this route, or I can go on the uncharted route. And in that moment, it's like, I don't know what the outcome is here. I don't know what, I know it won't look like that, but I don't know what it will look like. And at the time I had internships and I had job offers and I was looking at like social work and I'm grateful that I also had the understanding to know that I didn't have the capability at the time to be a support for anyone else. So I ended up myself through school. I had always nannied and like babysat and worked when I could, right? I worked my entire college career. So I like sent out this bat signal to all of those families. And I was like, hey, if anyone knows of anyone, like I'm ready to work full time, but like I am not quite ready to like get into social work right now and like be a full time, like I have a caseload full time. And so I ended up working for families for a really long time that just like through the network were amazing and wonderful. And what it allowed me to do was do a job really well and then also come home and fall apart. And there was a period of time when like I really had to like rebuild my internal systems. I had to rebuild like my social system and I had to rebuild my relationship with the higher power. And that didn't come until much, much later, but actually through coaching was one of the windows later, like a decade later, that kind of reopened that door for me in a very real way. So
coaching, meaning you seeking life coaching, you being the client.
I mean, therapy, coaching. Yeah. Anyway, like working with some of those families as a nanny was like one family in particular, they're like an older sister and brother to me. They're amazing. And they were always very aware of what was going on in my life. Like when I interviewed with them, I was like, I'm a fucking mess.
Like, you take care of yourself.
Here's why I'm a mess. Like I was very clear with them from the beginning because I couldn't. There was something in me that like I could not enter another commitment without having complete honesty there. I just could not do it anymore. And I was like, I don't know what this means. And I don't know how to, I don't know what this will unfold, but we're going to do it this way. they were wonderful and amazing. And anyway, they were the ones that actually like opened my eyes to what it like to want to whine. And wine was one of the things that I ended up pursuing a career in it after I left them. I worked with them until their youngest went into school and then I moved to California. And that's when I met my wife and really did a lot, even more healing out here, because it was another moment of like really following that intuition, that deeper knowing.
Oh my gosh, there's so many things to talk about.
Yes, it's like, I have a question.
Okay.
Like so many, we probably have a million questions because we know each other so much and yet we didn't know a lot of this today. So listeners, as you're all hearing this, we are hearing it for the first time as well. And it's like, it has floored me and I can tell in Christine's and Ty's face that we're like, wow. Yeah. First of all, the grace of whatever, you know, came over you that day when you were 13, right? Whatever that is that told you there was really no where for it to come from. It came from who knows where, but it did. And my question is, as you were going through all of this, and as, you know, your family, your friends, like the entire structure was falling around you, what kept you going?
I mean, quite honestly, a lot of numbing in the beginning. Mm. A lot of just like, I didn't know it. I don't know that. I mean, I'm sure I was like in a depressive state for some of it. The thing that kept me going was also finally experiencing what love like that felt like, and knowing even after we broke up officially for the last time that like that was possible. And also I think there is a part of me that like really loves the journey of inner work in some way, shape, or form. And I know not everyone necessarily is bent that way, but I just was. The discovery period of finding myself for the first time outside of like really having like open road to do that was terrifying at first, but then slowly like getting like a few things down, it like knowing that I had a safe place to come home to, knowing that I had at least a few people I could call, being in therapy, those were at least safety nets that I could explore a little further, right? So then it was like, okay, well, I started kind of playing with like dress a little bit, like, well, if I'm gay now, do I have to dress butch? Really, like truly, identity sort of like what?
Yeah, the fuck?
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
And it turns out I really like being feminine, but I went through a period where I kind of tried on some things. Like, how does this feel? How does that feel? You know? And I really, although I didn't have the language that we have now, you know, was really trying to tune into my body compass.
Becca, how old were you at that point?
I had graduated, so I was probably 21, 22, 23. I mean, the timelines, I'm really bad with timelines, so mm-hmm. like the timeline's a little fuzzy mm-hmm. in that, but I was like early 20s when I could look around me and see other people my age were like going after adulthood and da 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 da, because they like didn't lose any momentum. Like they were just going forward. And I was like, I really needed like a big reset. So there were times I felt like a failure. There were times I felt like, oh my God, I got to get my shit together because I'm just like nannying.
People being able to go after adulthood generally assumes that they have safety insecurity within their family systems, within their friendships, within their beliefs. Yeah. Like those are solidified at that point, which gives people a jumping off point. That was all
totally
taken away from you.
Yeah, but you know, at the time I didn't realize that completely. Of course. The time it was just sort of like, I just felt like I was treading water and drowning, but you're exactly right. Like that's so true.
And I think because the church loves to talk about love, and some churches do it really well, and some people, right? But when that love is so conditional, when you talk about the unconditional love of God, but then we act in such a conditional way and are willing to rob people from it, that's disorienting at its, that just, it's like the actual opposite of what, how we're supposed to live. I'm so sorry. And I'm just so proud of your journey. And you have every right to just sort of put everything aside and be like, I can't even touch that because it's all so toxic. And if that's all you've ever known, I'm so glad you're here now. I'm so glad you're here now.
Yes.
In a much more whole place. Yeah.
It's amazing.
My story is not unique. And I share it not to be like, because like now I feel so grateful that I have so like such a great, amazing, like chosen family support system. And, you know, turning 39 this week.
Yay.
And I'm in a completely different place. Like this year I have launched, you know, private practice, and every little bit of the way I find more fullness in this journey of discovery. But I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this work and doing this podcast with all of you, is because the in-between periods, like when you have like the flashes or the big moments of change, those are momentous, but it's also those periods when you're like nannying or when you're going quiet or going silent, where you're really doing a lot of this work and the tools of checking in like, how do you move forward from that place, right? Like, those are the questions that we're asking and hopefully giving some things that have really worked for us. So hopefully we can make this a little easier for others along the way.
Yeah, let us be your cubby.
Yeah.
Let us be your cubby.
So, Christine, you have a unique take on all of this. I'd love to hear from your perspective too, like some of your story and how you find uncharted living.
My kind of uncharted living came from a very uncharted situation, which I'm going to talk to you guys about. But ultimately, I realized that following the rules and listening to experts is bullshit. Becca, like you, I grew up in a very Christian home, very, you know, strict home, a little bit different than some of the things. I think we were a little bit more progressive than kind of how you were raised, but, you know, but a lot of like rule following, right? So just rule following in general. And my parents sat me down when I was in second grade and said, your principal called and said that I was going to a very small Christian elementary school, and your principal called and said, you are too smart for the school and you should go to this other private school where the smart kids go. Do you want to go? And I, you know, I'm like 8 years old. I don't know. They said, well, we want you to go to this school because, and I remember it so clearly, we want you to be able to grow up and have your own career and not have to rely on anyone, which is really kind of interesting to say to a 8 year old. But the way that I internalized it was, even though of course I have a very independent streak and certainly have done the career thing and all of that and been successful, thank goodness, what was implied in that is like, you listen to your teachers, you listen to authority, you listen, you know, you do the latter, you follow the rules. What ended up happening is I had what I now know the term to be is obstetric violence when I had my first son. I was married, got pregnant. I had gone through law school. I was living in California, you know, had sort of like you, Ty, like, you know, just like kind of following the rules in terms of like where we were living, what we were doing. I mean, I love yoga. So I was doing yoga every day, wasn't drinking wine, wasn't having tuna fish, like did everything I needed to do, you know, during pregnancy for this baby. And, right. Interviewed the doulas, had the birth plan, you know, the whole like nine yards. Uh-huh. And
it's another podcast. You know, it
was really exactly following the rules for pregnancy. I actually had a great pregnancy, very easy. It was working every day. I was doing my yoga. We were so excited. I had seen a doctor at the very first beginning of my pregnancy. I saw her twice, and I just had this. I had this intuition. I was like, "This is not the doctor for me." Like, I just didn't like. Something about her, I just didn't like her. I just had kind of an immediate, like, energetic, like, this isn't right. So I actually felt like I was super brave and was like, I need to change doctors. And so I changed doctors midway through my pregnancy. I had this amazing doctor for the whole second half. So about 3 weeks before I'm due, I go in, and then, you know, was going to go to work right after. And he said, the baby is breech. The baby is breech. So you've got some options. You know, we can immediately schedule a C-section, you know, because I like to force the C-sections on you. Or you can go see if you can get the baby to turn around. Now, I definitely not opposed to anything woo-woo. And certainly now I'm, you know, full immersed in the woo-woo. But I really thought that turning the baby around meant like I was going to see a witch doctor and she was going to like sprinkle some herbs and do like a chant and like lay her hands on my belly. And that, you know, Ben would like just rotate. Automatically just like turn to where he needed to turn. I actually naively, a lot of this story has me being very naive, even for having a law degree, very naive. And I thought that that's what it was. So we go to see this, you know, this, and it was a guy also. I'm like, this is weird. Like that I'm going to see a guy to like turn the baby around. Like, where's, where's Mama whatever from?
Men can't be witches.
Yeah. From Princess and the Frog. What was her name? Mama Juju or something. But he was like, so basically what we do is we get an operating room ready. And we're going to give you an epidural anyway. And then we're going to like stick our hand up and like forcibly turn the baby around. And 50% of the time you go into labor anyway. And we just do the C-section anyway. I was like, you are the worst salesman I've ever met. No, thank you. You will not be doing that. That sounds opposite to how I had envisioned it. And we're not doing that. So I just said to my husband, you know what? We'll just schedule a C-section, go on with our lives. It will be fine. So go home. During my pregnancy, I ate Outback ribs like 5 times a week. All I craved was Outback ribs from Outback. So that night... You know, it's 3 weeks, you know, so it's 3 weeks early. It's basically all like in this same day. I don't go back to work that day. I have ribs. And then about 2 o'clock in the morning, I start having contractions. So it's 3 weeks early and it is now 2 weeks before the scheduled C-section. Mm-hmm. And I'm in like, I can't breathe. I'm like in full on contraction. We're timing them and they're just, it is like fast and furious. So the joke is that like, I have like the Best Western womb, right? Kids want to get the heck out. Like other people have the Four Seasons. I'm like, we kick you out, early checkout. Mm-hmm. And so this baby was like, was coming. And now I start to freak out. We don't have like, what do they call it? The go bag. We're not, it's too early. The baby is not in the right place. It is the middle of the night. So I'm already starting to like freak out. We call the doctor. They're like, you need to like come in or, you know, whatever the answering service is. Okay. Your contractions are this many minutes apart. You need to come in now. Okay, fine. We get someone to watch the dogs. We go to the hospital. Again, I just need people to know I am in orange, basically rushed into an emergency room and then having like, you know, the shower cap kind of thing on my head and all of that. And we get all geared up. And who is the doctor that is on duty? The doctor hired.
The one you hate.
She's on duty. And I'm like, oh my God, she's, you know, but she's a doctor. Like, right? It'll be fine. This very cocky British anesthesiologist walks in. And he's like, okay, I'm going to do the spinal block. I mean, I was already in like so much pain from the contraction. And so the needle is like, you know, 2 feet long, it seems. As soon as it goes into my back, I'm like, something is wrong. No, 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 no. You're fine. You're fine. It just hurts. You have a low pain tolerance. I'm like, no, I don't. I have a very high pain tolerance. Something is wrong. Something is wrong. This is really painful. I'm totally dismissed. My husband likes doctor shows. So instead of being near me, holding my hand, and it's not that he didn't love me, but he was over with the curtain. So they basically put a curtain up like over your stomach and you're lying flat. So it's almost like in a magic show, right? Where you're like being cut in half type of thing. So I can't see what's going on other than the only thing I see is the doctor's face who I had fired because I just did not like her. And my husband is giving me a freaking play-by-play about what is going on. He's like, wow, they're like really ripping. So, you know, they're like ripping your stomach apart. Oh, wow. They're like dislodging the baby's like foot. He's like fascinated. He thinks he's like watching, you know, the Science Channel and that it's so great. And finally, they're like, sir, can you like go maybe be around with your wife? At this point, I'm like in pain in my back. Something is wrong. I know. And he's like, wow, they really took out all your organs. They're like all on the table. I'm like, so I'm just disembodied. Literally.
This is like the reaction video of like the trend of like, oh wow, that seems bad.
Exactly. Yeah, he's like really nervous or something.
But it's your own body. Everything.
It's like a stitchless.
Yeah. It's so crazy. So like they were on either side because of the way Ben was located. I mean, he was full on. I mean, trust me, when you meet my kids, you'll this tracks. They both were like in like Warrior II pose. So like the head actually had his head had to be like dislodged from like under my rib, and the arm, you know, I mean, crazy. So it wasn't like, here you go. It was kind of like, you know, unhooking them really from, you know, from my body. But I didn't realize because I hadn't planned for a C-section, like what that entails. It basically entails you being taken apart. I mean, you are taken apart. Then they kind of just give you this baby, which is, I mean, it's, of course, it's wonderful. They lay him on your chest for like 1 second. Someone takes a picture. Then they wheel him out with my husband. So I just remember laying there underneath the brightest light possible. It's 4 a.m. He was born at like 4:30 in the morning. I just didn't even know what happened. I'm in so much pain in my back, and yet I can't feel anything from like the waist down. And they're basically like, you know, almost like putting things back in a picnic basket. Like, oh, this goes in here. And this, like, so they're putting your organs sort of like back together, and then they staple you with like a staple gun. So I like, and I didn't see Ben for like, or my husband for like 2 hours. After I knew something was wrong. I just knew something was wrong. But no one was believing me that something was wrong. They're like, no, it's fine that we just took a baby out of you. Of course, you know, you're going to be a little sore. I'm like, no, something is wrong. So then they're giving me morphine. It's not working. The whole thing was ridiculous. My doctor was on my regular doctor had gone on vacation. So then like, I didn't see him. And listen, my child is perfect. He was perfectly healthy. He was a wonderful baby, easy baby, just delightful, hilarious, still to this day, just so hilarious. But that day started a journey of 15 years of chronic pain. And I have seen every doctor known to man. I have seen neurosurgeons and physical therapists and Eastern doctors. I have done acupuncture. I have done cupping. I have done weird kinds of yoga, weird kinds of stretching. I have had every kind of epidural. I have had every kind of like ablation. You name it, I have tried it. Any medication, I have tried it. Whatever this doctor says, yes, I'll do. I follow the rules, right? Follow the rules. And everybody thinks they can save you. What I was on a lot of narcotics for like a really, 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 really long time. And the problem is that when you go to, you know, Florida passed a lot of rules where like pharmacists now have the power to deny you medication, even if your doctor has called it in. Mm-hmm. So basically when you show up, they would be like, essentially like you don't look sick enough, and would like always doubt whether or not I needed medication. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, if I don't have this, I'm like in a fetal position on the floor screaming. And you know, just there's no, either I have to look too good or I don't, you know, because if you look really bad, then they think you're a junkie. And then if you look too good, then they think you're like selling it or something. So I would be judged by the doctors. Why are you still in pain? You shouldn't be in pain anymore. I would be judged by the pharmacist. You know, when I would mention it to friends or even family, like they're like, how's your back pain? I'm like, well, it's still there. It's really bad. Something's not right. And everyone kind of had a different, you know, diagnosis and all of that. And then I'd say, yeah, I mean, I'm getting through it. I take, you know, opioids. And then everyone would launch into some lecture about how bad opioids are for you. And don't you watch the news? And it's like, I couldn't win. And I had surgeries. And I had a surgery that the doctor, supposedly one of the best in the country, went through, said, well, the worst of your discs is at the lowest. And so I think it'll be better for you if we do a surgery through your stomach, like go in from the front. And I was like, you know, that seems that seems weird, but
yeah,
you know, like I don't know. I didn't go to Harvard Medical School. Like, this guy supposedly knows.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a long way from the front to the back, you know? There's like lots of stuff you kind of have to like dig through and like push aside.
According to your husband, there's a lot to remove.
There's a lot to like take out and put back.
Play by play for him. He can watch a whole other episode.
He can tell him everything.
National Geographic.
Was he like, yes,
Dan? Oh my gosh. Sir, please go to the other side of the curtain. You shouldn't be back here. Like, cutting the umbilical cord was not enough for him. He wanted to like anyway. So they did the surgery and they replaced a disc, and then they were like, oh yeah, actually it was way worse than we thought. No wonder you were in pain. I'm like, right. So by the time they went in, it was bone on bone. The whole disc was gone. So they had to actually, what was supposed to be an hour surgery ended up being like a 6 hour surgery. Actually had to pry the bones apart, right? Put in a new disc, put in a cage. I have like a nice cage with screws and all sorts of things. And then they're basically like, okay, you're fine. I was already at like a 10 out of 10 pain. I basically went to like 100 out of 10 pain. I was like, what's going on? Now my foot is burning and feels like on fire, like I'm touching a hot stove. They're like, oh, I guess we just hit a nerve or something. So I spent that Christmas with still an excruciating back pain and my foot in a Home Depot, you know, 5 gallon bucket full of ice. My husband would just fill it with ice and fill it with ice. And I would sit with my foot in the ice because something, they had hit some sort of nerve. And I went to acupuncture again to try to, they gave me medication for the foot pain. Cause they're like, oh yeah, this is like what's called neuropathy. I'm like, okay, what's the medication? And the medication at that time, this is back in 2012 when I had the surgery. So I didn't get surgery for 5 years. Right. So Ben was born in 2007. I didn't have surgery until 2012. So it wasn't like I just rushed to get surgery. I had spent thousands of dollars and done a million things first and then did it. Right. And this was after MRIs and arguing with insurance, like the whole nightmare. Mm-hmm. And again, I speak English well. I'm smart. And I would always make me think, oh my God, this system is not meant to help you. This system is meant to crush you. And yes, especially if you're a woman, but if I had a different color skin and I didn't speak English, I went to some real like dark places, but the medication they gave me for my foot started making me gave me really suicidal thoughts. And when you read the fine print, it says, and I'm like, I've got two babies. I can't do this. I went off that medication, but it's been a really, really, really long, very lonely journey. And because I'm so high functioning, or I had been high functioning, it's like, you don't look like you're sick. You don't look like you're, you know, whatever. It was just really hard for people to relate to. So the pain had gotten worse at the end of last year. And I went through another whole set of x-rays. I went through a whole nother set of MRIs. I went through a whole nother set of everything because something was sort of still not right. So I'd just been doing pain management for so long since the surgery. I got an appointment with the head of neurosurgery at University of Miami. So again, like top of the best, where he required you to send you his scans before he would even meet with you. So he wouldn't even like agree to meet with you unless you had sent him your scans first. So I did that. He agreed to meet with me. I made an appointment. It was all the way down to Miami. It was still kind of COVID time. My husband drove me, but he wasn't then allowed into the doctor with me. I sat for 4 hours in the waiting room. I kept asking, "What? I have an appointment. Like, what's going on?" They're like, "Well, we're just really busy." And I was going to FaceTime my husband when the doctor came in so we could go over what is going on, because this guy specializes in doing second surgeries and things like that. And he comes in, sort of breezes in. Oh, yeah, I guess it's sorry. It's been a long wait. And says, yeah, you're too risky because you've had a bad reaction before. And you're too young and you seem like you're doing you seem like you're pretty functional. And then waltzes out the door.
No, fucking no. Oh,
and I called David and he's like, okay, is the doctor there? I'm like, he's already come and gone. And I just got in the car and we're down in Miami. We had to figure out picking up the boys because it's a weekday. It's a work. It was a Friday. So now we're stuck in traffic. We spent the whole day, because he kept texting, have you seen the doctor? What's going on? And it's not like I could say, well, just go leave because he's my ride.
Yeah.
And I got in the car. I cried all the way home. I took several medical marijuana gummies. I laid on the couch and I just told my husband, I'm like, this is where I live now. This is where I live. I basically I give up. I can't do this anymore. If I didn't have my kids, I love my husband so much. He's fabulous. But if I didn't have my children, I would have just been done. I would have just been done because it's too, every cell of your body constantly is in pain. And I think this, the not being believed and just being dismissed, whenever I would go to a doctor and say, they'd say, well, what happened? Was it an accident? I'm like, well, it was an epidural and something happened. They're like, oh no, that's not true. That can't happen. But if every time I talk to a woman or a nurse, they're like, oh yeah, we know plenty of women who have never been the same, after this. And we were having, there was lots of some family stuff. There was other illnesses going on. My dog was sick at the end of last year, but I just realized I was like, if I'm going to continue, I have to heal myself. I have to heal myself. I cannot listen to these doctors anymore because all I have done is listen and been like, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do. And instead I realized I need to ask myself, what do you want to do? And have, and make that be the thing that I do. Okay, I got to find something else. So I ended up finding on the internet, right? Instagram knew that I was crying on the couch and was like, here's this recommendation for you. And Instagram's always great in recommending shoes and all sorts of things.
Algorithm. But it's the algorithm.
The robots knew what I needed and sent me this ad for something called Curable. And it's an app for chronic pain and it's all mind body stuff. And I was like, I literally am at rock bottom. I just started it and I was seeing a little bit of improvement, but I took some time off of work. I started to just because it was literal life and death at that point. I just literal life and death.
Because your rock bottom, Christine, is what you're saying is that your freaking rock bottom is following everybody's good wishes and advice and expensive privileged position in your life. But your rock bottom is the result of doing everything that you were told to do. And then on top of that, being too high functioning to be believed as a woman that your body was experiencing the pain it was experiencing. Tell me where I'm wrong.
No, it's 100%.
Sorry, I'm getting
following the rules. No, following the rules nearly killed me. Nearly killed me. I mean, I joined this group, this support group, and I found a community. And it was people who were all high functioning. Everyone was like, no one's a junkie on the street. I mean, no offense. Although I have empathy for the junkies too. I get it because I actually, the last couple of years, got myself off of the narcotics. Once Florida finally passed medical marijuana laws, I started switching to that. But I had been on them so long that even under a doctor's care, I had severe withdrawal, severe. Mm-hmm. I mean, the headaches and the nausea and the sweating and the crazy stuff with your head, and thought I was doing well trying to transition to something a little more natural, but it was actually the community that saved me. So the people that I did a 12-week program in community with other people, and I have decreased my pain by 90%. I am down through the community of those people, through saying, I'm not going to have the same work schedule anymore. I'm not going to have the same stress level. I am not listening. This is not to say don't go listen to doctors. I believe in doctors. I believe in science. But you know what? Mm-hmm. My intuition was like, I just put all of my power in their hands. And I put all of the decision making in their hands. And I followed blindly. And I did not tune into what my body was saying.
Well, they weren't even believing you.
No.
Right? No. I mean, you finally found a community of people that believed what you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they had had it too.
So it was like, oh, exactly. You look too well to be in so much pain.
Also, the whole time, weren't you a full-time lawyer the entire time? You're in this much amount of pain.
Raising kids.
With two young kids at home.
In your master's program yet?
I started my master's program. Yeah, last year I was doing that as well. And then the life coaching.
So you were working full-time. You were in school. You were parenting. And you were like figuring all of this out.
Yes. But what's interesting is that, you know what? I had had the first sort of intuition to not have that doctor, which was correct.
Yeah.
That was the right one, right?
Yeah.
And it was sort of overridden. But the next, so I got pregnant about 5 seconds after I had been. And yes.
Yeah.
I had just gone back to work. I was starting to feel a little sick. And my husband's like, maybe you're pregnant. I'm like, there ain't no way. And I took like 20 pregnancy tests. They were all positive. And I came out and I was like, we will not speak of this. And I just did whatever my body wanted to do during that pregnancy. Even though I was in pain, I was like, I want to have a Diet Coke. I'm having a Diet Coke. I want to have a glass of wine. I'm having a glass of wine.
Yeah.
And I made sure that and of course this baby Joey was breech as well. And then what's sad is that the doctor said, don't have any more children because they'll all be breech and we shouldn't do any more C-sections on you. Which is tough, but, when I went to the operating room, in setting kind of everything up, I told my doctor, I must have a female anesthesiologist. I will not
good for you
have the same one. I must have a female one. I insist. And he was like, okay. And so I had a female anesthesiologist. I explained what happened before. Cause when she started to put the needle in, I said, oh, is that where it's supposed to go? She's like, yeah, where did this guy put the other one? And I was like, right here. And she's like, oh my God, no. And I think because like I'm a defense lawyer, so it didn't even occur to me to like sue the pants off of them, you know, like, but that second birth, seamless, easy, my doctor, the right anesthesiologist. So it really, I now listen to what my body is saying. And I listen to what it needs and I now have so many more tools in my toolbox through this program and through just putting margin in my life and just paying attention to myself. I'm no longer kind of disembodied. So I put my body through hell with all of the treatments and all of the stuff, just trying to make it behave and trying to subdue it and trying to numb it and trying to like fix it. Right. Cause I was just broken. I just felt broken. And this year was a year of getting off of the chart, right? And literally I'm in a different, doing things a lot differently and I've reduced my pain and it's been amazing. So.
Wow.
That's my story.
Interesting. Yeah. Uncharted pain management.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That's exactly.
Listen to yourself. You can trust yourself. You can trust yourself. I was right all along.
Yeah. You know? And it's incredible that, as you said, you know, the system, you having, you know, the medical insurance and resources to do this, to do that, to try this, to try the other. And even with all of that, you were still not being heard.
No.
You weren't believed, right? From the very beginning when you're like, this doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
And that just constant how the system overwrites right? Yeah, what somehow, we're saying about our bodies.
Even as accomplished as I am, I was not deemed to be a reliable narrator of my own story, of my body, of my own experience. And
because what you're saying is just because the quality of being female, because you have everything else, right? You're white and straight and privileged and homed and food, all security, all the things, but don't believe that crazy woman.
She's just going to get the drugs and sell them in her neighborhood. So anyway, but the term is obstetric violence. And once I found that out, it really hit home how...
I didn't know this existed. Makes so much sense that it does, right? Let's just not believe them. They don't know their bodies. The experts know more. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. I want to start by saying so much love to all the women that are not being heard, that haven't been heard before, particularly in such a vulnerable moment as giving birth. We see you. We see you. Yeah. And there's ways forward. But I think starting with the relentless listening to what we need. So for anybody that is listening, that is Colombian, that grew up in the 80s, was a teenager in the 90s, what you're about to hear is going to sound very familiar. And some of you probably have already forgotten what we had to do, because human beings, apparently we tend to normalize the things that, you know, are like outrageously crazy in most circumstances. And all of a sudden they become normal. We adapt, but they were pretty fucked up. Right. So I went to the school that had an American name. So I grew up in Bogota in Colombia, and we were fortunate enough to be able to go to this school that was for, you know, privileged kids. When we were growing up, all these cartels, the drug cartels that everybody talks about and is so fascinated by, and there's so many TV shows about, and everybody seems to only know that about Colombia, which drives me insane. Next time you run into a Colombian, don't ask them about drugs, okay? Because that's very offensive. Don't ask me if I've seen the Netflix. Don't ask me about something else.
People do that.
So, oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah. And I don't even want to say his name, right? But that's all people are obsessed about Colombia. What was happening when we were growing up? And so these shows have asked, because of these shows, they have shown a lot of the things that were going on. Even my husband was like, were you in Bogota when this was happening? And I was, that's right. Yes, I was. I kind of have forgotten, but I was. So what we had to do, so there was all this war cartels going on, and we have a guerrilla. I would say that Colombia is a beautiful, vibrant country that unfortunately violence is very much braided in our history, So we've had violence forever and ever and ever. But what was happening is that the cartels were at war, and it was bad, right? So they were... Instead of, like my kids do fire drills at school, we would do bomb drills at school, okay? Wow. So we would have to like train, if there's a bomb in the school, what do we have to do? Have to open your mouth. We have to go to this area. And like, so we would know what to do if a bomb was about to explode in our school. You would also, there was like this, all this process in case your parents got kidnapped and you didn't know what to do after school. So, you know, there was so much kidnapping, as you guys have probably heard, you know, a part of the operation of the war was financed by kidnapping people that had money to pay to be released. And so since we were a part of a privileged school that had people with a lot of money, so we were one of those schools that were targeted to be kidnapping kids or the parents being kidnapped. So we all know someone that was kidnapped at some point, or we have family members that were killed when it's a very sensitive, horrendous chapter of our history. But that's what was going on when I was a teenager, right? And so one of my sisters is like, yeah, thank you for God that most of your friends actually left. I'm like, no, I think we were just going to study, you know, because we wanted to be fancy, wanted to study abroad. She's like, no, 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 think this through. And I was, oh my God. So what was going on is that it was scary, right? It was scary. You would go to the mall where all the kids were, like, there were bombs in the malls. There was an area where all the privileged kids used to hang out. Like, if you're, again, if you're Colombian, you would, from Bogota specifically, La Zona Rosa, Calle 82, all of those places where all the play, that's the old way of saying the cool kids, used to hang out. So there were bombs in those places, right? And so there was always this very long lines to go into a mall to get into the garage because they had to check every single car that there was not a bomb in the car. So this would entail, there was a dog that would walk around the car. Then the trunk would have to be open. They would check all the trunk. And then the doors had to be open because they had to check that there was nothing strange or weird. They would look with mirrors underneath the car to make sure there were no bombs in your car. So we were all, this was a drill to go to a mall. Your car had to be checked for bombs. So we were like, okay, you know, the long line to go to the mall. You had to plan around the long line to get into the garage of the mall. And so all of these things are happening as we are like, you know, 15, 13, a bomb could explode at any moment.
Oh my God.
Or someone that you knew could be kidnapped. Or you couldn't really do road trips because if you left the urban area and you were unlucky enough to be stopped by some people that looked like the army, but they were really the guerrilla, they would kidnap you. So for years and years and years, I couldn't go anywhere with my parents and my sisters anywhere in the car, even though it's such a beautiful country to drive around. It was just one of our favorite things. We couldn't do it any longer because you could be kidnapped. As I'm like remembering all of this, I think, oh my God. So my generation, the idea of staying in Colombia was like, no, you have to go anywhere else in the world in order to be able to have a good future because who knows what's going to happen with the country, right? And so I finish high school, I go to college, I graduate. And the idea for all of us is, where are you going to go, right? Right. Where are you going to go? Because staying home is like, and many people stayed. But what I would say is that I have a group of girlfriends, we're 12, like very, very close friends that we have been friends since we were little. In Colombia, you go to the same school from kindergarten to 11th. We didn't have 12 grades. So you always stay together. And it's about 12 of us. And I was counting and only 4 of them stayed home. Everyone else left.
Wow.
Right. So it was almost like even though you were blessed enough to have privilege and had all the resources you needed, it was kind of like looked at like, oh, this is not very smart to stay here. In order to have a good future, you need to leave. And so I had kind of forgotten that is where I came from. And that's why for me, it was like, of course, I'm leaving after I finish college. And so my sister says that she remembers me. I had a map of the world one day on the dining room table at my parents' house. And I was just thinking, where should I go? And we talked about Spain and Europe and the U.S. and, you know, all these countries. And she was much younger than me. And she remembers vividly thinking, wow, my sister is really, she needs to find her own map because she doesn't feel safe here.
Wow.
And so it's a really interesting, so there's two components of this, right? Like what does it do to you as a teenager to grow up in an environment like this?
Mm-hmm.
And I always think, you know, people that are, feel so strongly about immigrants, and just to connect for a second with the idea that most people don't want to leave their family and their country and what they know and the people they love behind. Most people live because there's a reason. And a lot of times has to do with safety, right? Can we survive? Can we be safe? And even though for me, I had I was set up to, I was bilingual, I was an engineer, I had everything. My parents had done everything for me to have a successful life in Colombia. There was a question of safety, and a lot of, and some people stay and they've done amazing, right? Because the story changed and things got better. It's a different country now, very different country, but that idea of safety is typically what is pulling people outside of their country, of their family, away from their families. And so I didn't remember that that was really the driving force behind me joining a beautiful group of women, for which name of a podcast I cannot fucking say. Okay? So that is why many good things have happened, right? But it's like, why am I a foreigner? Like, why am I here? And even though I am deeply grateful, I always get a little bit like defensive when I hear immigrants like not talking in a grateful way. All of our stories are different, but like, you know, I think we should be grateful with the country that is hosting us, because we're not from here. And yet there's so many blessings that have, I mean, you work hard and you do well in this country, even though there's many things that are seriously fucked up, as the medical system, as we just talked about, one of them that drives me bananas. I still, after all of these years, there's many instances in which I feel truly out of place, truly like an outsider. And that will never stop being the case. I have to come to terms with the fact that I will always feel different, that I will, particularly when I, as an example right now, when I go to an event at my kid's school and I'm surrounded by all these moms, I feel so out of place. I'm like, whoa, I'm so different. The way people parent here, the way people relate to each other. Sometimes I just want to scream. I'm like, when am I going to feel at home? When am I going to feel like I belong here? And every single place that I go? And the answer is that will never happen. And slowly I'm starting to discover how to be okay with that. So I go back home to Colombia, and because I've changed already, I'm kind of like, I love it here, but could I live here full time? I'm not sure anymore, right? There's many things that I have already changed, because I've spent so many years here and I have a family here. And so it's been hard for me. It's like an everyday battle of how to feel comfortable, how to feel that I belong, how to live an uncharted life, right? It's an everyday, every single day struggle. And I am listening to a book. I'm not reading it. I'm listening to a wonderful book, David and Goliath, which was suggested by a dear friend of mine. And in this book, Malcolm Gladwell, he talks about why sometimes we choose to be a small fish in a big pond when we have been big fish in a small pond, right? Mm. Did I say that right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
So, and that's exactly what I did, right? I was like, yeah, comfortable. I had my parents, my family, my beautiful house, everything. And then I'm like, oh, I'm just going to go over there and be a student and don't barely speak English. I mean, a little bit, but not really. And I'm just like going to be this little fish. And I still feel like a little fish in a humongous pond. And then I decided to go work at Silicon Valley and be the only Latino, the only woman in most of the meetings, the youngest person. Again, small fish in a humongous pond. And what I'm slowly starting to figure out is that I can create my own pond, right? I can slowly create places, community, I can choose many of my experiences. Not won't always be the case, but I can, in many circumstances, choose where I can comfortably swim without feeling that I'm drowning, without feeling that I'm in waters that I don't even understand. I mean, my son is in middle school now, and a lot of the things that the jokes or a lot of that sayings, I'm like, what are you saying? And Chris is like, oh yeah, what do you mean? I'm like, well, I didn't go to high school and middle school here. I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
You're so not alone.
It's like constant.
You're not alone.
It makes no sense.
It doesn't make sense.
Okay, good. It's not just me.
No. Chris is lying.
I feel so lost. So lost.
Join the club.
Yeah.
It's the endlessly vulnerable process of not being from here.
Yeah.
Of not being from here and everything that that means. And just learning that the value that you can slowly develop in your life is choosing the ponds where you want to swim. So that's what I want to say to all of our listeners today is, you know, me feeling, hopefully you will can connect with the human part of that other human in front of you that says there was a reason. There was, in many cases, safety, in many cases, not feeling that you would have a good future where you are. There's all kinds of stories, of course, but that I would say that the vast majority of people that have left their country, there was something about not feeling safe, not feeling that they would have a good future wherever they were at, and that we carry the pain of not being at home every single day. Mm. So that is how I live a life every day without a map, without a chart. I'm learning to be okay with not feeling always like an insider, if that makes sense. I'm going to be an outsider and an outlier a lot, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Some days, not most days, but some days.
Diana, thanks for sharing that, because I would never know that from knowing you the way.
Yeah.
All of that backstory is there and you carry it with you. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of Christine's story is you're too high functioning for me to see your pain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it connects to Becca's story because I didn't know any of the Bible college shit and the conversion therapy because she's too high functioning for me to see her pain. So all of these women in the world, the next time you see any person who's high functioning, don't assume they don't have their own struggles.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes.
Right?
It's like we all have our own, what is like resonating so deeply is like, these are such beautiful examples of being handed something and then just having to like sort of figure it out, right? And there's like, Diana, what you're talking about of like just getting comfortable with like going off script, going off, like it doesn't need to be exactly like that. And if we can reimagine our individual lives collectively, we can reimagine and chart differently as well, right? Like,
yes.
Not like, impacting not just our own personal spheres, but then maybe hopefully the greater good.
Yeah.
Just for other people and maybe giving them a little bit more room when we kind of put them on our own chart, like, oh, you're this person. Oh, you're the immigrant or you're the soccer mom or you're the wife or you're the lesbian or you're this. We can be all those things at once.
Yeah, we're too fast to map people and put them in a specific place, right? And we don't really know what's behind any of that. And it's been our intention to share with all of you some of our deep stories of pain and struggle to tell you, to remind you of that. What Ty just said is you may encounter high-functioning people that look on Instagram like they have the perfect life, but we all carry our good load of pain that we are struggling with and that we're trying to swim. We're all on this together, trying to figure this out. Very difficult things.
What we've learned today is following the rules is bullshit. Living life is endlessly vulnerable. We are all living uncharted. We all have love. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us next time for Uncharted Living.
Thank you so much for spending another week with us. Follow us at Uncharted Living Podcast on Instagram and TikTok. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And please like and share this episode with your favorite fellow human. Uncharted.